Thank you, Melanie, for the opportunity to be here today. Well, in the last three great presentations, you know, gave us a broad overview of issues surrounding genetic resource conservation, distribution, utilization, and the like. So here we will change gear a little bit and then talk about specific crop commodity, in this case, sorghum. I am with Kansas State University now, but before that I served as a national sorghum research program leader for Ethiopia. So a lot of information that I share with you today is based on the experiences that I have acquired while working for the Ethiopian National Program. Maybe for those of you not familiar with sorghum, I will briefly go over the origin, distribution, and importance of sorghum, and then discuss about Ethiopian sorghum genetic resources and some of the factors that really shaped the sorghum genetics resource profile that we have in Ethiopia. You know, the challenges surrounding the global movement of germplasm in general has been thoroughly discussed, so I will not really dwell a lot on that issue. Well, as some of you know, sorghum is believed to have been originated in northeastern parts of Africa, in a place that in contemporary geography we know as Ethiopia and Sudan. It looks like it was cultivated for many, many years in that region before it moved out of that area, because we still see so many different botanical races of sorghum in that region. But later on, the crop moved westward to as far as West Africa, Senegal, where it is, you know, certain crop races or sorghum races got adapted to the region. For example, the Kodedem race in the Central Africa region, the Guinea race in the Western Africa part. Similarly, the similar movement to the south again led to adaptation and expansion of the Kaffir sorghums into the Southern Africa. Still today, you can find almost all botanical races in the countries, in the areas of origin, except probably the Guinea race that is not very common. The crop is believed to have exited Africa through some sort of trade relationship that existed at that time, went to the Arabian Peninsula, where it is grown today in the highlands of Yemen, and then probably through Yemen or through a separate route, it reached India later on, where it got evolved to different forms of sorghum over there that are basically dura-based, but a little bit different from the duras that we know in the Ethiopian islands and in Yemen. I don't know how many years, but many years after that, the crop, you know, went to the other side of the Himalaya and ended up in China, where it got evolved to a completely different race, probably the only race of sorghum evolved under temperate condition, called the Chinese cowlings. And then during the slave trade, the crop extended through West Africa to come to the Americas. So wherever it went, I think the crop went through a lot of adaptive changes, and then all these countries that received the crop have diverse forms of the crop. It is not only the countries of origin that is that has the resources. As to importance, sorghum is a major food crop in Africa, where it was originated. It is used for making different kinds of foods, so that has actually maybe affected the selection target. So there are different kinds of varieties that are used for different types of foods. It is also an important feed source, although people in Africa don't really grow it for feed purpose, but the byproducts of the grain will be used as a major feed source, like the leaves, the stalks, after the grains are harvested. And nowadays, especially in the urban centers, the grains have been being used as poultry feed also. various types of beverages are made from that, and then recently the crop is being used as a major feedstock for lager beer production, as well as for ethanol, particularly the sweet sorghums. I brought this just to emphasize how important this crop is in Africa. I think Africa is the only continent where sorghum acreage is increasing. Everywhere else is going down. And over the last 50 or so years, the area under sorghum has increased by 167%. And then it is still much lower than the 233% increase in the population of Africa. The genetic resources of sorghum in Ethiopia. In Ethiopia is recognized as one of the Vavilovian centers of origin and the diversity for several crops, which includes sorghum, coffee, teff. I don't know how many of you are familiar with teff. It is a predominant cereal grown in Ethiopia. And then an important oil seed, we call it nug. The scientific name is Gzoetia abyssinica. I'm sure many of you are not familiar with it. The Ethiopian mustard, very, very much similar to the canola crop that we grow in this country, and finger millet, so many others. And it is a center of diversity for numerous known world food crops like tetraploid wheat, barley, maize, and the like. Like I said, it is Ethiopia is endowed with wide genetic diversity of sorghum because it is lies in an area that is recognized as a center of origin for that crop. And then it has also contributed significant amount of genetic materials to the world sorghum germplasm collections. I think about 15% of the sorghum germplasm that we have in green originate from Ethiopia. I believe about 5,000 accessions, a total out of 40. It's not only the diversity and the number, but the Ethiopian materials also harbor numerous useful plant traits. The drought tolerance that comes from the Dura sorghums has been widely utilized in breeding programs here in the US and elsewhere. The stay green sorghums that we call. The yield potential and the grain quality. The Zira sorghums that come from western part of the country, I think that particular germplasm may be not well represented in the world collection, is a very good source of yield potential, grain quality, and also disease resistance, actually. I'm sure you all are aware about high lysine and high protein digestibility sorghums that were discovered in the 70s. Those come from the northern Ethiopia sorghum collections. This is just a view of the kind of variety, diversity that Ethiopia harbors for sorghum. If you can closely see, you can find almost all botanical races, including the bicolors, that are not very much grown elsewhere except Ethiopia. So some of the factors that really contributed to shaping that kind of germplasm profile are maybe numerous, but the environment, the ecology of the country should have a significant contribution. The crop management system that different communities in different parts of the country use should have perhaps contributed. And the forms of utilization, you know, Ethiopia is made up of over 100 different ethnic groups that have their own different language and then culture, and also have different forms of, you know, and the types of food that they process. So although they all grow sorghum, the way they utilize is different. So farmers for many, many years selected for these different characteristics that probably contributed to the kind of genetic variability that we see in that country today. This is an agroecological map of Ethiopia on the left for you, and then to the right is the sorghum production areas of the country. So if you superimpose these two pictures together, you can see that sorghum is grown in almost all of the known agroecologies of the country, except regions that borders the Somali, that is pretty much very dry, and then only nomadic people live in that area. You know, for ease of identification, the Ethiopian Sorghum Improvement Program, you know, categorized this diversity based on ecology into four ecological zones. The hot and the dry lowlands, these are, I don't know, my mouse doesn't, okay. These are found in northern parts of the country, the eastern part, and also down in the southern parts of the country, and then this lies below the altitude of 1,500 meters. So it's normally dry, very early maturing type of sorghums are adapted to these areas. The next one is the high altitudes that we find in the central highlands and the maybe eastern highlands of Ethiopia, where very long maturing varieties are grown. Normally that area is has about maybe more than 2,000 meters of altitude. And the mid altitude is between there, between 1,500 and 2,000 meters of altitude. In addition to that, we also have a unique types of sorghums that grow in western parts of the country that is hot and a humid lowland. This area receives really very high amount of rainfall, but because of its altitude, it is really very warm, and that is where the zira-zira sorghums I was talking about come from. So, like I said, crop management practice, people of different ethnic, cultural background, you know, use different methods to grow the crop. So every time through generation, they have made their own selections, that varieties that adapt to that system were selected gradually. So soil cropping is very dominant in all parts of the country. Ratoon crops are widely used in southern parts of Ethiopia, actually. The first grow sorghum, the first harvest is doesn't give them actually a lot of yield, but the second harvest gives much higher yield than even the first harvest. So these are unique types of sorghum for that region. With the introduction of early maturing varieties through different international organizations like INSORMIL and ECRESAT, you know, very extra early maturing varieties have come in there, and then double cropping has really is taking off in that country. So those, again, is shaping the germplasm profile of sorghum in Ethiopia. Intercropping is practiced in mainly in the eastern part of the country very much. Forms of utilization, again, sorghum is produced in almost all agroecologies, but utilized in a completely different ways. So farmers have classified their sorghums based on their utility for certain purposes. For example, sorghums that are suitable for bread making, that most of the time we find them to be waxy, tan-type sorghums, farmers call them sindelamine, which means it's an Amharic word that translates, why bother with wheat? So sorghum can do the same. Again, there are sorghum types that are preferred for local brew that has high fermentation efficiency. They have the name for that also, gansabber, which means, again, ferments so fast to the extent that it can break the, what is that, the container? Yeah. The very nutritious high lysine sorghum that come from northern Ethiopia, locally called Wetet Begunche, is also again, that means they are equating the nutritive value to milk, so Wetet Begunche means like milk in my mouth. So they have those kind of different names of, you know, identifying their own varieties that they know are suitable for specific uses. And this happened over hundreds of years. Well, about management and the utilization of sorghum genetic resources in Africa in general, compared with the time that this crop has been there in Africa, really the collection and improvement of sorghum as a crop has been is really a very recent initiative. It started during the colonial era, actually, and it coincided with the inception of modern agricultural research. Modern research means just collecting materials, evaluating for yield and then agronomic values, and then those that look good promoted for production to farmers. So before the 1960s, there were about only four sorghum research centers in Africa. Those are not actually primarily based for sorghum, but they were established for evaluating export type of crops, but on the side, research on sorghum started because of the importance of the crop for the local area. One is at Serere, Uganda, where the National Sorghum Breeding Program is based for that country now. And the other one in East Africa is in Sudan at a place called Abu Nama, which is far south of Wad Medani, where the National Sorghum Research Program for that country is based today. And in West Africa, the oldest one actually that was established in the 1930s were in Bambe, Senegal, that still continues to work on sorghum. And another one in northern Nigeria at a place called Zaria. So these were the oldest sorghum research centers, and then, you know, they may not be really a research, just collection and evaluation of sorghum started in this region. A real research really did not start until international organizations like FAO, ECRISAT, and INSERMIL came in the 1970s and the 1980s. So these organizations really contributed significantly to capacity building of those local institutions in terms of training the local staff, in terms of germplasm acquisition, and also variety generation. So in general, sorghum research in Africa is pretty much recent, and the collection and the conservation of sorghum genetic resources is also very recent. We don't know how much genetic resource was lost before that effort started, really. In Ethiopia, sorghum germplasm collection and then sorghum research in general started in the 1950s by Haramaya University. That was the only agricultural college established with assistance from the USAID, actually, through the Point 4 program with Oklahoma State University's involvement. But systematic collection and the conservation of sorghum genetic resource, again, did not start until late 1960s when, with the support obtained from the Canadian government, the Ethiopian Sorghum Improvement Program was established. And also, a little bit after that, the Ethiopian National Gene Bank established. So these two institutions collaborated for many years until today on germplasm collection, conservation, and also on variety development. But, you know, because of some physical limitations, a lot of the collections made in that country is limited to, you know, the major road routes. So whatever material that you have here in the gene bank or in ECRISAT or even in Ethiopian National and in Ethiopian gene bank are collected from just next around these major road access areas. So there is a lot of places that have not been reached until today that really harbor significant amount of sorghum genetic resource. Hopefully that can be done someday. The Ethiopian Biodiversity Institute currently holds about 10,000 accessions, and they are developing their capacity every time, rejuvenating about 2,000 materials every year in collaboration with the National Sorghum Research Program. Currently, they are building a capacity to a little bit more characterize the materials, both morphologically, biochemically, and also through genetic fingerprinting. That effort is going on, and hopefully will be implemented someday. The materials are, you know, because of so many reasons that we have discussed this morning, are mainly limited to use by local universities, national research programs, or regional research programs. So they really don't make, you know, to other places, even in the region, not just here in the U.S., for many issues that we discussed this morning. That is really frustrating in terms of conservation and collection of germplasm materials in that country, and also in terms of attracting seed industries to that country because of that strict germplasm policy. A lot of international seed companies shy away from that because they will find a difficulty moving materials around. So, well, let me talk a little bit about problems surrounding that movement of germplasm. You know, we have said a lot about that. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but my mentor, Dr. Gabisa Jetta, was telling me that 35 years ago when he started as junior sorghum breeder in that country, everybody could, you know, local or foreigner can step out and then get into the field, collect as many materials they want, bring them, and then go through the airport without anybody questioning about that. And then that was just 30 years ago, not really that long. A lot of changes really made since that, and then we don't see that luxury anymore. In my view, you know, there are two competing interests that probably over time led to that. One is the multinational ag industries wanting to protect, you know, their materials or their products, which is very understandable because they make investment on it. And the other thing, you know, the developing countries who looked at this over years, you know, came up with the idea that it is their own materials that are really making a difference elsewhere, so why don't we control this? So to me, both claims are genuine, can be addressed, you know, if there is a clear dialogue. But the consequence of not doing that is really frustration of efforts of enhancing productivity, you know, accelerated loss of genetic resources, because genetic erosion is really, really going on rapidly in that, in Africa in general, and then I know in Ethiopia it is, and that really risks, you know, efforts to achieve global food security. So, like I said, I'm not going to discuss a lot about that, but I am convinced that the companies who invested on coming up with new technologies, new products, need to protect their property, and then should be able to recover, you know, the money that they spent on that one. I also believe that farmers in developing countries who kept these materials for hundreds and hundreds of years really need some sort of reward if that material is going to make some difference on the ground. So I think the issue of equitable benefit sharing, germplasm conservation, collection that we discussed this morning definitely makes sense very much, but the problem is when it comes to the implementation of that on the ground. The CBD Convention of 1993, the treaty, the new treaty that 2009 or 2004 that was started?
2004.
You know, if everything is implemented the way it was written on the paper, I think that will be wonderful. I don't know who is going to do that. I hope those who initiated that effort will continue to implementation of that on the ground. So these are a few of the things that I picked out of the convention and also that of the treaty that really we discussed this morning. So thank you so much, and then that's it.